Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Alex Clark, and Michael Keynes, an editor at the TLS, is here with me. Welcome, Michael.
Thanks, Alex. Hi, how are you?
I'm very well. I'm recently returned from the mountains of Switzerland, or rather, actually, the shores of Lake Geneva.
Oh, my word. What on earth have you been up to?
I went to the Jan Michalski Foundation, which is near Morges, which is near Geneva, and I attended the Bibliotopia Festival, and my part in it was to be interviewing Lauren Groff, but there were all sorts of fabulous writers there, including Maza Mengiste, Philippe Sands, who gave this wonderful performance based on his book The Last Colony with a pianist and an actor, and it was just fantastic, and also gave me a chance to practice my very poor French, because it was a kind of bilingual conference. So sometimes when there was an event in French but you could have English headphones, I eschewed the headphones and tried to follow what was going on.
You just went with the flow. And how did that go? Did you improve over the course of the festival?
Over the course of the weekend? Well, you know, maybe. Maybe not so much.
That's good. That's great. maybe is something.
I have to say, if you ever get a chance to, which you should, you go to this festival. It is in this most incredible, very modernist, beautiful kind of spare, almost brutalist building on the side of a hill. It's absolutely wonderful with these fantastic artworks.
That sounds worth the trip.
It really was. But I have to say, at one point I found myself looking at a collection of rather kind of beautiful sort of breeze blocks with some kind of weights on it, and I thought, well, this is definitely an artwork, and took a picture of it. And then the next day I realized that there were things that they were putting up to hold the tents down, so it wasn't an artwork. It was in fact an entirely but maybe that's just art as form and function and beauty, though.
I think that's absolutely the right interpretation.
And what about you? How have you been?
Oh, I've just been hanging around boring old London trying to improve my English, but it's not working. I did have the quite a fun little adventure last week. I went and saw a collection of all the Shakespeare folios from the 17th century that will only interest, obviously, Shakespeare nerds and biblio nerds and that kind of thing. But it's very unusual to get them all together in one place. They're all being offered for sale by a London bookseller for a combined price of, let's say, around £10 million.
Oh, my goodness.
And I think a Shakespeare expert who is really committed to seeing your folio could go around the world and see, I don't know, 100 odd copies or something like that. But for anyone else, any mere mortal, it's quite difficult. So I enjoyed that. That was quite fun.
And what was it like? I mean, how were they displayed? What was it like sort of physically seeing them?
The first folio actually lives in its own sort of bomb-proof case, as far as I can tell. And this particular copy of the folio is almost complete. It's got a few preliminary pages that are facsimiles, but mostly it's all there. It's all clean. It's got lovely kind of binding, and the same sort of goes for the other three folios. They're really beautiful copies.
And did you feel this kind of sense of wonder and sort of presence?
Not exactly what I expected. I mean, the thing is, I have seen folios before, but individually, different copies in different states, because really no one is all the same as far as I understand it. You know, it's printed over such a long period, it changed in the print shop. But I did sort of feel there was something extraordinary in seeing this book evolve over time. You know, the first one is 1623, so there's an anniversary for the folio this year, obviously, and it goes through to the 1680s. So you're seeing a kind of change in his reputation. The fourth folio is the biggest of the books, the sort of grandest of the books, although it's not the sort of rarest or the, you know, the most impressive in other ways. But you did see this sort of story evolving. So you could see really a kind of Shakespeare afterlife, and just the beginnings of, you know, this incredible reputation, of course, that Shakespeare enjoys today.
Wow, that's fascinating. It's going on sale presumably quite soon.
Yes, I think they're all on sale now. The first folio alone is, I think, about 6.25 million. And I'm pretty sure they'll all sell and the collection will be broken up. So it's an interesting moment to see all of these together right now. They'll be appearing at various book fairs, I expect, unless they're bought first.
I fear we may just have to scrape the funds together to buy the catalogue, mayn't we?
I think maybe that's what we should do, yes. Or maybe just look it up online. Should we do that?
Yeah, we'll do that.
Okay.
We'll do that. Tell us what's in the paper this week.
Well, once again, I can't deny this is a week for incredible variety. That seems to be something the TLS specializes in. We have this absolutely intriguing memoir, essentially, opening the paper by Jane Maas. It's a memoir of Philip Roth and about how he was haunted in his life and his fiction by a student romance. I will say no more about it than that. It is a really intriguing little piece of, I don't know, Rothiana, if that's what you call it. And, you know, a great thing to have. Now we've had two biographies of the man already. We have Catherine Sutherland writing about the Porter sisters, pioneering historical novelists.
The book is by Devoni Loza, isn't it?
That's right, yes.
And a friend of the podcast. I can't wait to read it.
That's right. It's a terrific book and terrific sort of review. Really interesting. Right next to Michelle Roberts writing about George Sand. So we have plenty of literary history and literature in this week's issue. We have David Throsby talking about economics. We have an extract from David Baddiel's new book about being a Jew through or despite atheism.
As you say, and that's only some of the things. I mean, there's
that's
an awful
only
lot
some of
the
things.
Yeah,
I could
there's
talk
an awful
about
lot
more,
in this week.
That's it. There's quite a lot going on. So I think it's really a, you know, enjoyable, fun issue.
Well, thank you so much. Coming up on this week's show, Lamorna Ash on Max Porter's tale of teenage angst. And will Jonathan Taylor be seduced by story? We find out.
Deepen your understanding. Enhance your appreciation of the world's greatest civilizations with Martin Randall Travel, the most innovative and influential specialist cultural tour operator.
Join like-minded travelers on meticulously planned tours for small groups covering destinations in the UK, Europe, North Africa, the Middle East, Asia, and the Americas.
Expert speakers carefully selected for their specialist knowledge stimulate the imagination and enliven the intellect.
Celebrate privileged moments in unforgettable places. In Rome, experience the splendour of the Sistine Chapel on a private after-hours visit. In Venice, St. Mark's Basilica in similar quietude.
A passion for excellence and a dedication to enrichment.
Book today at martinrandall.com.
Still to come on the show, Jonathan Taylor on the uses and abuses of narrative.
But first, it's been 8 years since Max Porter's debut novel, Grief is the Thing with Feathers, appeared on the scene and was thereafter made into a stage show by the playwright Enda Walsh, starring Cillian Murphy as the Ted Hughes scholar whose mourning for his wife is interrupted by the arrival of a large crouching crow. In 2019, it was followed by Lanny, in which a forest spirit called Dead Papa Toothwort accompanied a young boy through his semi-rural adventurings. Now comes Shy. Once again, a novel in which mysticism blends with the everyday, this time at a residential school for violent young men. The writer Lamorna Ash has reviewed the book in this week's paper, and we're delighted that she joins us now. Hello, Lamorna.
Hello, morning.
This is such an intriguing book, but in terms of Max Porter's work thus far, his novels thus far. The book I didn't mention was The Death of Francis Bacon, which seems slightly out of the flow of what seems now like a trilogy. Does Shy seem like it follows on from Grief is the Thing with Feathers and Lanny?
I think it does, and I almost feel you could trace the character through where Lanny, much like Shy, but in a younger, less inhibited way, is at one with nature, is outside of the ordinary sphere of society, somehow can commune as a kind of middle spirit figure, quite like Dead Papa Tootworth. And you feel that with Shy, this is like the 15-year-old incarnation of that, where he can no longer happily sit in this in-between world. He's thrust into the challenges of being older, of puberty, of testosterone, and that makes it much harder for him to navigate both the natural world and the world of humanity, the men that he's around. And I suppose with Grief was a Thing with Feathers, again, there are these, he does children absolutely beautifully, Max Porter. And I think the voice of the boys, which is these three monologues that happen in Grief was a Thing with Feathers, they similarly have this natural ability and closer relationship with mysticism and the natural world than other people.
It's funny, isn't it? Because Grief is a Thing with Feathers, because so much of the character, obviously there's the crow, but we see it through the widower. And sometimes you can almost forget about these two boys who are also in the novel, but they are very young boys. And you see it as much from their point of view, don't you?
Yes, you definitely do. And I feel like Max Bortix, who's an editor at Granter First, has this like amazing eye for how to do structure and how to bring readers in. And I feel like through having the boys who more naturally would accept this strange version of grief that comes in as this crow from Ted Hughes' crow poems, in a way that gently lowers the reader in to then accept the fact that the father too must take this figure that usually would be created by a child to get through grief. And so through the three of them, you're then able to really take seriously the idea of crow. And I suppose the difference, what I was thinking about with my review, is the way that Porter's relationship with animals and with animism shifts over the course of the books, that in Lanny, again, you get Dead Papa Tootworth, who you take very seriously. He is a literal character within the story. And with Shy, there's animals, but they're more peripheral and they have this strangeness. And in a similar way, it's the natural world that might save people, that might bring them back from the brink, from the difficulties that the human relationships and humanity and this moment of challenge for young men imposes on Shy.
Yes, yes.
Lamona, just with that interest in mysticism and sort of masculinity in mind, are there other writers who come to mind, or that this particular book brought to mind?
Yeah, definitely. So I think I was thinking a lot about Ben Lerner's The Topeka School, mm-hmm. because similarly, both of them are set in the 90s, and the two authors, who I guess are equivalent in other ways to these sort of big male writers at the moment, were teenagers themselves in the 90s. And there is this sense of trying to return and think about masculinity then at quite a different point from now, where a lot of our sense of misogyny was more below the surface. It wasn't spoken about as much as it is with teenagers today. And similarly, in the Topeka School, he chooses to have multiple narrative voices. So there's the character of Adam, that's sort of a version of Ben Lerner. And then there's his psychiatrist parents, who have this distance and are able to question the ways that the boys behave. And then there's this strange figure called Darren, who I really think is quite similar to Shy, who, again, is dreamlike, I think has difficulties understanding what's happening around him, and is slightly taken advantage of by the other boys. And similarly, there's actually quite parallel scenes where in Shy, you get this moment of Shy failing at a sort of sexual interaction with a girl, and it all going wrong, and his feelings get transmuted. I think it says at some point, shame turns to rage when it's not supposed to. And that happens with this figure, Darren, in the Topeka School as well.
There's almost a moment of comedy there, which, I mean, there shouldn't be, because it's a horrible scene in lots of ways, that moment where, as you say, Shy is having a sexual interaction with a girl that's going, he's remembering what happened before he ended up in this residential school. And it's going kind of well, and then it goes badly. And then he gives her, and I'm almost laughing saying it, he gives her a dead leg, and she's just completely horrified. And he's like, but we did it all the time at school. And he's suddenly a kind of rivalrous teenager again, rather than this man who was wanting to have a sort of young man's brilliant sexual experience. And there's almost a moment of comedy there in what is, in many ways, is a funny book, but also isn't.
Yes, and I think that's the real generosity of Max Porter. He loves his characters. You really feel that. And so in them, you're able to recognise the naivety of it, but the fact it also has consequences. When a little kid gives another kid a dead leg, it's just playful. They don't have that capacity for violence. Whereas when Shy does it, it still comes from this place of naivety. Mm. And I think humiliation as well, that I suppose we talk about this so much with young people now, of at what point do they have accountability? And yet who's teaching them the way to behave with one another? And these are, particularly with Shy's group, drunk kids, kids taking drugs, getting into situations, but they're still naive. They're still that almost like pre-lapsarian sense of them trying it all out and then being horrified. And he doesn't, in that scene, it's that he almost steps out of himself and says, how have I got to this side of the room? Ah, what can I do to make this go away? I'm going to give her a dead leg. And yet for her, and we don't get to see really from her side, but we can feel it, that for her, it might have felt like this violent encounter, this shock.
So this is the kind of thing that he's done. And it is always this series of events where he just suddenly almost sort of freaks out for a moment. Oh, so it's the story of Shy, the titular character, who's ended up at this school called the Last Chance School, again, kind of slightly humorously. But it really is his last chance, isn't it? He's just done this series of things and withdrawn from his mother, his stepfather, any kind of helpful teacher or helpful adult friends that he has. And he's just in this kind of cycle of self-sabotaging, isn't he?
He is, yes. And again, this is Porter being great at structure. He sets the book up, and this doesn't, I don't think, give anything away, but Shy is leaving Last Chance at 3 a.m. He's got a bag of flint rocks in his backpack, and so he's heading towards this lake. And so we have this real sense of what the trajectory is, that there might be no way out of it. And I suppose the book then, whilst retrospectively building up our sense of what happened to him beforehand, bringing in these other voices in this very portery way of distinct typography, but at the same time, we know that he is just walking towards the lake and something will have to intervene or not intervene. But I think whilst reading it, having reread Porter's previous books, you always have a sense something will intervene. I don't think he's a writer who wants to do damage or permanent damage to his characters.
It's so funny. I mean, I read it, and at the moment where the lake comes into view, to which he's walking, the penny suddenly dropped for me. And I don't know whether it's because I was so captivated by his voice. I missed that now, because I was actually thinking, why has he got a rucksack full of stones? Do you think I'm just a very bad reader, Lamorna? You can't really answer that.
Yeah, I think you are. No. I think, but then I think you could say the same about me, that I instantly was like, oh, here we go. It's a Virginia Woolf moment. And maybe that says something that my pessimistic reading of it, or cynical reviewer head, where you're thinking, I mean, I know that I read in a complete different way when I'm reviewing books, and I tend to have to read them twice and probably would then read it again differently a year on. But I have that sense of being like, what's the kind of tectonics happening here? Like, what's the architecture of the plot? Okay, rocks, backpack, I know.
And also the other thing we should say about it at a very sort of basic level is it's such a short book, as all his work has been, that you know that he can't take very long to get to whatever the reason for the rocks in the backpack were. You're not really cynical. I think I was just being a bit dopey, because the minute that the lake did come out into view, I immediately thought, obviously, Virginia Woolf. It's a sort of horrible, horrible moment of jeopardy, isn't it, in the narrative?
Yeah, it definitely is. And I think, again, that's where Porter wants to go. And I suppose this might also say more about me as a reader, but knowing that that was going to happen, and even it is this descent, this like going down through the fields to get there, it has this extraordinary ending that the last few scenes, I think, are the strongest in the book. But I still wanted more. And I almost wish that he had begun it earlier or ended it later, that it's so perfectly done. It's so short, it's so slight, that I think there's more room for, I said this in the review, but I do think it's his best character he's done.
It's and funny I think you should say that. I did think, I mean, Alex mentions that there was a stage adaptation of Grief, is the thing that says, and I just thought it sounded like this takes place over, from your review, I gather, it's a sort of concise, it's 3 hours, isn't it? And it's an intense piece of action. And that's another aspect of his writing. I suppose if it's not entirely unique, it's quite distinctive to want to do that. It's almost like a kind of odd sort of scarred sort of script for something that you could see put on stage here again. Yeah.
Lamorna, you described the book as polyphonic, and there are other voices, like Shai's mother, stepfather, his teachers, the counselors. There's even a documentary, a voiceover of a documentary that's being made about the school. And it's typographical the way he indicates their interventions in the narrative, isn't it?
It is, yes. And I don't know if this is me being unfair. For me, it doesn't work as well as the rest of the story because there's something limited about those. And I think, and perhaps it's because I see that form of experimentation so much. That seems to be, to experiment, you have to do typographic innovation, set bits of your book up like poetry. And yet there's something that it's lacking the density or the richness of poetry, not even narrative poetry, but that feeling that there's underneath feelings happening. I think that often here, the interventions are like, yeah, this moment of another voice, but nothing around it. And again, I feel like if those had been expanded, because I suppose the polyphonic quality is different with both Lanny and Grief as a Thing with Feathers, that they're strong monologues and you feel each of those characters, each person has a richness in those books. Whereas here, they come in momentarily, they disappear away again. Like the documentary, I don't really have a sense of what Last Chance is like. I know that that too is coming to a close. It's probably going to close down. It's probably going to get bought by someone rich. There's this, you know, that political sense that Max Porter always has.
And it's the 1990s, isn't it? There is this historical setting to it. So you have this kind of idea of property development that's going to happen. And as almost being on the cusp as a country of all that kind of exploding and all these things like progressive educational institutions being hugely under threat, but it's never overtly said. I mean, we are in Shai's head and we're thinking through his eyes and mind and memories and sensations, but it's still there, isn't it? And I suppose that's why Porter put it into that kind of documentary sort of style. It had to be something just slightly different, but it's almost, are you saying it sort of breaks into the idea of this being a single consciousness?
Yes, possibly. I think it's that, and sometimes it's done again, this beautiful, quite slight sleight of hand where you get, there's another character, I believe he's called Benny, and these other boys who are there, and you get the sense that some of them, you understand why they've ended up there, that some of them have had real trauma, that some of them, one of them has experienced a lot of racial abuse, some of them have difficult families, and that Shai, he has a stepfather and a mum who are really loving, and you have this sense of how have you ended up in this group, like what's happened to you, and that I think that's when it's done really nicely. But again, you almost want to see all these boys in direct contact with each other, which I think that to go back to Ben Lerner, he does really beautifully of the ways the boys egg each other on, the ways that power and race and class play out amongst young boys, I think would be really interesting to see. I was also thinking on the 90s bit, something I love in the book is that Shia is obsessed with drum and bass and jungle. And I had a really good time listening to the songs that he played. And I think Toby took the bit out, but I talked about Origin Unknown's Valley of the Shadows, which is this brilliant jungle song that has loads of samples in it. And I was thinking that actually sort of what Max Porter is doing here with these different textual bits coming in of other voices is a bit like samples in the music that Shai listens to that come in and sort of shift the tonality of the story or of the music in the case of jungle.
Toby is the editor, isn't he? And a frequent guest on this podcast.
Yes.
I'm going to bring in a bit of sort of extra literary kind of knowledge here, because I interviewed Max Porter quite recently about the book. And he said that it's his most edited book. He edited it over and over and over again. And the last time he edited it, he was listening to 170 beats per minute music just to make sure there. And I totally got that when he said it. I mean, that's it. That's going the extra mile, as it were. But I totally understood it, because for me, the rhythm of the book was incredibly powerful.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, that makes total sense to me as well.
He also said, by the way, I'm just throwing this in there, that he had originally conceived of the project in a loose sense. It had started life. Chai was not a boy in the 1990s. He was a medieval manuscript illustrator. He did a year of medieval research. Then he decided that wasn't that he wanted to change. So then he had a Victorian setting for the book. And those things he was telling me might, you know, that sort of work, that framing and setting might go somewhere else into some other kind of project. But it's the same character throughout. So this kind of very evocative 1990s setting also could have been another time, another place. Isn't that interesting?
That's really interesting. Did he say why he then ended up migrating into the 1990s?
Well, we talked a bit about the sort of this particular historical setting. I mean, one of the things was that, you know, as you mentioned, it was when he was that age. So it was very familiar to him, although he said he wasn't, you know, his own musical tastes. He liked drum and bass, but he had a much wider sort of musical canvas, whereas Shai is completely obsessed with this one form of music and what it represents. But I think historically speaking, I mean, I think something interesting to him about that feeling of, you know, the sort of 90s kind of feeling of invincibility to which Shai's sort of fallen through the cracks. There's an amazing moment, isn't there, when he's having a fight, you know, again, it's a memory of a fight that he's got into almost unwittingly, and he smells there's a posh boy who he's having the fight with, and he smells the CK1 on him. And I thought it was such a brilliant detail, because it means you were there, you were actually smelling it, and you thought, yes, that was the 90s.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, the other bit's great. For me, it was Lynx Africa was the kind of 10 years later, the boy smell.
These are terrifying Proustian aromas you're bringing up here. Can I just ask one slightly veer off, but come back to something you mentioned, Lamorna. Just one last thing, really, which is that you talked about reading differently when you're reviewing something. Can you tell us a little more about that? I mean, that's a really interesting idea to me.
Yeah, I suppose, because it's a shame in a way you have this sense that you know it has to go somewhere in the end. So I'm thinking about structure as I'm going. I'm plotting it more like what my piece will be in response to it. I'm probably thinking about comparisons more. I'm literally writing bits of it down on pieces of paper and jotting things down. But I do also have a sense that my first version, and I don't worry about this when I'm just reading for pleasure, but I have a sense when I'm reviewing that I often get things wrong the first time around and I have to read things twice, which is much easier when it's a book like Shy compared to, say, John Foster's Septology, which costs like so long.
Oh, sure. Right.
But yeah, but I also think then the other way around, that I was talking to someone else who was actually he reviewed Shy as well a bit later, and he was saying that he had this initial sense, which was he wasn't so sure about the book, and then in his review found that he was enjoying it more, and it's almost like you work out your feelings about the book through writing it. So in some ways I feel really lucky when I get to review something, because just by putting your stronger opinions that you might say to someone in a pub down on paper, you have to back them up, and so you start to become more generous, or you start to feel to have a richer understanding of the book through doing that.
Yes, I agree. And you're so right. As well as interviewing, I'm also reviewing it. I have read it sort of now three times, and my feelings towards it have really changed, not in terms of that sort of basic critical line of whether to bring it to this level, but whether you give a kind of thumbs up or thumbs down. But just it complicated the narrative so much, knowing what was coming. I mean, that's, again, a very basic thing to say. But when you have a book that is about a literal journey, albeit a very short one over the course of 3 hours, and really not very far at all, but you still, knowing what's coming, really changes the way you read, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, it absolutely does. It's funny also, someone said to me that as a reviewer, you write, you have your interests and they'll come up again and again, and you're often asking the same questions. And I balked at that and was like, no. And then realized another review I did recently where I was looking again at the way that animals have this sort of transcendent quality in John Berger, actually. And then realized that, and I put it in the review, that in Lehane, my favorite moment, probably one of my favorite moments in any film, is when this cow turns up in a tower block and it shifts the way that the character feels. And so I realize I'm responding similarly, maybe looking for the same things, looking for transcendent qualities or strangeness or moments that take you out of the narrative flow or shift the direction.
Oh, by the way, that's one of the things one loves about reading a really good review. And this is a really good review, I thought. So interesting. But I read that and thought, God, I must go back and watch Lehane again and remember that bit. And it's just always sends you in other directions, doesn't it?
Yeah. And actually, I remembered Lehane wrong because I thought that it was a horse that passes through the tower blocks, but it's actually a cow.
Michael, are we really intriguing you? Are you going to immediately rush and read this book?
I am intrigued. I've only read Grief, and I thought that was very curious and strange. But I came to it from that opposite point of view, from the one you just mentioned, Lamorna, of not having to read it for any particular purpose or deadline or anything like that. So I came to it with all the kind of praise echoing in my ears. And I that put me off, I got to say. But yeah. I actually will pick this up. It sounds fascinating.
Just thinking about the trilogy, and it's a loose trilogy, and I have sort of taken Francis Bacon out of it, although it's by no means unrelated to the rest of his writing. But do you think over the course of these three books, do you think he has told us something important or interesting or original about boys and masculinity and growing up and trauma and, I suppose, also polyphony in novels?
I think definitely about boys and masculinity, and about, because his characters, they're not even Shai, who has these difficulties, who is this boyish figure. He still has this, I don't describe it, but it's not entirely masculine. It's not what we think of the stereotype of masculinity. I tell you what I'd be really interested in is I'd love to see him take Shai on to the age of 22, 23, because when I think about it, I think some young men have a really hard time at that point looking back on what happened in those teenage years, particularly now, and when you got things wrong, but you now have this adult head to look back on it,
and the shame starts to go. I mean, the shame, yeah. There's an awful lot of shame in Shai, but of course you feel it's intensified because the things he's done are the things he's done.
Yeah If I was to take something about masculinity in it, is that you get the double of Shai. You see what he's done, but you also see this creative, interesting, sensitive figure underneath. And I think you always get that. I mean, I worked with teenagers for quite a few years, and you get the bravado and you get the sort of bossiness, but then you get maybe a kid to write or to tell you about music they love, and there's so much more going on. And so I suppose that's what he's doing really well. And it does feel like there's a political motivation to Porter's work, which is like, look, people are more complex than you think. And he has this real sense of people being good, I think. I think there's a real humanism in his writing. And I mean that in a really positive way.
Lamorna, thank you so much for coming to talk to us about Shai and about Max Porter and about everything else in between. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been great.
Still to come on the show, Jonathan Taylor on the uses and abuses of narrative.
And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. I'm Michael Keynes, and I'm here to tell you that storytelling is everywhere. It's on that packet of cookies where the manufacturer seeks to tell you about their story. It's menacingly prevalent in politics, not least when it comes to the disseminating of nationalistic or racially defined myths. It's in every journalistic essay that deploys a personal anecdote as a means of broaching the theme that then turns out to be the real subject of the piece. And as it happens, there is a review in the TLS this week that does begin with this otherwise rather overused device of the personal anecdote. And as a TLS editor, I'm afraid that my instinct would be to cut out such mundane matter. But the review I'm talking about happens to be the work of Jonathan Taylor, who teaches creative writing at the University of Leicester, and who is in this case very knowingly recalling the time he was invited to give a talk to students taking a master's degree in brand management. These were students, Dr. Taylor found, who already knew about Aristotle, who knew about conflict and epiphanies, having studied how these things work, not in modernist short stories or Shakespearean drama, but in a well-known brand of smoothies. Jonathan Taylor joins us now to talk about the pervasive art and problem of storytelling, as presented in the latest book from Peter Brooks, the distinguished Yale professor of comparative literature, a book called Seduced by Story, The Use and Abuse of Narrative. Jonathan, thank you for coming on the podcast. And thank you for your terrific review of Peter Brooks's new book. First off, what exactly is it that Professor Brooks thinks is problematic about storytelling?
I think he's written a sort of dark sequel to the first book he wrote, Reading for Plot, when he talks about the sort of magic of storytelling and the way it's propelled by desire and the compulsion that people have to read stories. But actually, in this book, he's talking about how that compulsion can be used to sort of amoral ends, really, that there's nothing inherently good about storytelling. And it can be used in all sorts of contexts, but all sorts of ends. So he's not sort of saying that storytelling is bad or good. He's saying that it can be either or both. The idea, I think, that power of storytelling, which, you know, the first book's partly about, can be used in all sorts of ways. And that maybe to use Marx's metaphor, that that power is in danger of being a sorcerer who's lost control of his spells, and that we've ended up with a situation where storytelling is everywhere. Of course it is, but that power has been used in all sorts of different ways and all sorts of different quite disturbing contexts at times.
Well, I suppose it's really clear, isn't it, throughout history? I mean, just one example, every totalitarian state starts with a story, doesn't it?
Absolutely, you know, and I was thinking, although he doesn't mention this explicitly, I was thinking of Mein Kampf, of course, which is a story, and it's a sort of founding text of what happened sort of a couple of decades later. I think it's a really compelling idea. I sort of and that there is certainly something about brands, as you mentioned at the start, Michael. You know, but capitalism and global capitalism has woken up in the last sort of 20 or so years to that amazing power of storytelling, and that every brand has its story, every social media company has its storyteller. You know, CEOs are storytellers, aren't they? And adverts are mini stories. So I think the kind of the idea that capitalism has got hold of this power, I think that probably is true.
Do you know, it's very much on my mind, because I was telling Michael that I've been on my travels recently, and they took me at one point to London, where I stayed in a hotel. I have to name it, otherwise the story doesn't work, but I promise. This is not product placement or a paid advert, I promise. But the chain is called Citizen M. And when you go into the room, the telly is already switched on, and it says, "Welcome, Citizen Alex," in a kind of embrace of egalitarianism. I was totally part of it. And I also noticed that it has a kind of stripped back aesthetic. The rooms are quite sort of no frills, very comfortable, but no frills. So one of the things it doesn't have, because it's very modern, is an ironing board. But when you are in the corridor, you notice a sign that you may avail yourself of Ironing Heaven, which I never went to find Ironing Heaven, but I think it must just be a room with an ironing board, presumably. I mean, I hoped it might mean somebody was there to do your ironing for it, but I don't think it did mean that. But it was just, you were sort of drenched in story. And I suppose one of the interesting things about that, and you mentioned that, you know, the well-known brand of smoothies, is that either you like that, or if you don't, you just get very irritated. But it's a bit of a gamble for advertisers, isn't it?
Funnily enough, that brings to mind something that struck me while writing the book. Was what he doesn't talk about quite so much is the omnipresence of poetry. That poetry is everywhere. And it's something that I often talk to my students about, actually, that the power of metaphor and the power of simile, again, has been corporatized and branded and so on and so forth. And this idea we have that poetry is some kind of little marginal concern of small publishing and so on and so forth is nonsense, because clearly, like politicians and corporations and adverts use poetry all the time. It's and poetic techniques all the time. Whether it's good poetry or not is neither here nor there. And the same with stories. Whether actually good stories that smoothies are telling is another matter. But they're effective in their own terms.
So, Jonathan, I mean, thinking about this power of storytelling in the wider world also makes me think about the power of storytelling in avowed works of fiction, which you bring into your review. We've just been talking to Lamorna Ash about Max Porter's new book, which I can see as this lived-in extraordinary kind of world. How do we differentiate, though, in general, between the power of storytelling in that context and this broader one? Does Peter Brooks talk about this difference?
He does, and he has a really sort of interesting sort of couple of chapters on this, where he talks about the way in which somehow reading novels is different to listening to the story from a politician or from a brand, that novel readers are very sophisticated and that they have a double consciousness where, on the one hand, you read Middlemarch, Bleak House in a totally immersive way, and you're totally buying into the fiction of the novel in the as if, but unconsciously at the same time, you know it's fiction. You know that you're buying into the lie in that way. And that double consciousness, he thinks, is incredibly valuable, because it's a sort of inbuilt skepticism. So you enjoy it entirely immersively, but at the same time, there is a sort of almost Brechtian kind of skepticism that's going on in another part of your mind. And obviously, being Peter Brooks, there's a lot of psychological and Freudian metaphors as part of his discussion. And it is a sort of unconscious skepticism going on. I think it's a really powerful idea, actually, that we read novels with that kind of double consciousness. And clearly, like, novels post Middlemarch are very conscious of that sort of idea.
It made me think about how interesting it is to think about, and I know it's a problematic term, autofiction, which it seems to me one of the things that it tries to do is make that artificiality of the author, character, text, real world, much more elided and much more complicated. So it's not, it matters to just having, you know, autobiographical material in your novel. It's the matter of what you say this character who might or might not have the same name as the author really is. What is the status of a fictional character? And it seems to me you're right. I mean, it's, people are doing very interesting things with it in contemporary fiction, aren't they?
Obviously, one of the things that I'm really interested in is memoir and autofiction, and memoir, I think, always has that weird sort of almost wave-like formation where memoirs often start extremely immersively at a particular moment in a particular scene and then pan out a few pages on and then pan back in and so on and so forth. And that a lot of memoirs work like that. Memoirs, and as you say, autofiction in a slightly different way, sort of play with that sort of double consciousness all the time. But, and nothing's ever 100% immersive. Even a Shakespeare play is never 100% immersive. There's always that kind of slight Brechtian distance at times.
That's one of the really interesting things I think about this Peter Brook's approach, isn't it? Is that it doesn't necessarily take some kind of conscious nudge on the part of the author. There's a built-in sort of, as you're saying, sort of Brechtian quality to this, that you can't, if you're holding a book, something seriously wrong if you think that is the world. You know, and on the other hand, you know, that if an author, as Alex is saying, is pushing towards this kind of idea of, oh no, this is nakedly my life, I'm barely pretending this is fiction at all, that's sort of pressing up against the glass, but of course it can't cross that line, and part of that particular feel comes from that pressure, maybe that direction.
And I think what Peter Brooks's point is that total immersiveness, where you try and efface the fictionality, you efface the kind of materiality of a book, or you're in a Hollywood cinema and you're in darkness and all you see is the screen. So total immersiveness is actually dangerous. It's actually politically dangerous, because when you start to try and persuade people that it really is real and there is no double consciousness involved, that's when something dangerous happens. And I think Brecht says something similar, you know, but that sort of bourgeois realism really can be actually politically dangerous, because you start to believe that, you know, you're watching a Hollywood movie in a cinema surrounded in darkness, Dolby surround sound, huge screen, and you start to actually believe, oh my God, Spider-Man exists. Yeah. Or something like that.
Yeah.
Well,
Sorry.
It's really interesting. I guess the title of the book, you totally hints at this, and you're talking about Freud and etc. But it's desire as well. It's desire on the part of the reader or the viewer for that sort of total identification and immersion. And I certainly know that when I find myself really enjoying a novel, I actually want to be in its world, which I guess is dangerous, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think the book doesn't quite answer that question of that sort of, and maybe that will be the third in a kind of unofficial trilogy, that answer of, well, it's incredibly powerful and seductive, as the title suggests, and we want to be immersed. So how does that balance with also, you know, keeping one foot out of the immersion, or you know, so most of you is immersed, but you've still got a foot on the beach. That's a bad metaphor, but what that means is that potentially that really fully immersive texts and stories might be actually more seductive, more powerful in some ways, and you can see that obviously he's talk about religions and also political religions and so on and so forth, and their danger. So maybe they're actually in some ways more powerful than novels.
I think part of the answer you provided in your review, I didn't really know how much this you agree with this point from Brooks himself, but it's the value of critique maybe is the answer to how we grapple with our own desire. Story gives us something we want, whether we're more prone to it or not nowadays, or you know, it's spread out and pervaded different contexts where it wasn't there before. We were getting something, broadly speaking, you know, from studying the humanities and learning about how critique works. And there's the basis for defending the humanities there, if, say, one ever needed to do that. Is that fair?
Yeah, and I think so there's a kind of scepticism there whereby what he's saying, as you say, is that literary criticism and criticism of all kinds becomes immensely important in dismantling and challenging some of these really dominant stories, but also from a personal perspective, gaining that kind of double consciousness, even when you're listening to the most powerful politicians or reading the most powerful newspapers or buying the most powerful sort of brands, that scepticism that or critique or criticism that you gain from humanities actually is incredibly important in standing back from these myths. And I totally buy that, actually, in some ways. Maybe buy isn't the right word in this context, but I totally get that. Because I think that one of the things that is important in my field in teaching creative writing, that, you know, that actually telling good stories is one of the things that I teach, and that's incredibly important. But also thinking about how stories work in a critical way is also important. There wouldn't be any point doing creative writing at university. That actually there is a kind of, that you kind of try and sort of encourage a double consciousness on the part of students, whereby they are both creative writers, but also alongside that, that they've got to know the mechanics and what they're doing and what and think critically about what they're doing and reflectively about what they're doing. And I do believe that's what makes I don't want to be hierarchically, but what makes a really good writer is someone who has both, I think.
One of the things that I guess is sort of around this, and I don't know the extent to which Peter Brooks goes into it or indeed what your views are, but we're also talking about who gets to tell the stories. You mentioned hierarchies there, who gets a seat at the storytelling table, and that leads you to the kind of idea of the canon, doesn't it? And what becomes a mainstream of stories and what is marginalized. Does he have anything interesting to say about that, I wonder?
Most of his examples from the novels are very canonical. Obviously, Henry James, George Eliot, and so on and so forth. So he's very much, I think, talking about the canon and holding that as texts that do play with double consciousness. But no, absolutely. And there's certainly like one of the problems, I think, with the corporatization of stories is that clearly the people who own the right to tell these very dominant stories are big global corporations, CEOs, and also major politicians. And they become the sort of dominant voices, I think, in this what he calls storification of reality. But as you say, those stories that saturate our reality are going to have bigger voices if they've got more money behind them. Mm. And I think that's really important, is a really important point that he makes.
Even storytellers need big backers, shall we say.
Yeah, and it's obviously true, you know, in many ways that we are some, the stories that we hear most on TV are obviously adverts and then politicians and so on and so forth. And to tell stories on TV, on Netflix and so on and so forth, you need a lot of money. you need a lot, clearly, you know, you need a lot of money to make a Hollywood movie. So it is a sort of, there's this massive weight of finance behind the most powerful stories that we hear every day.
God, it's interesting because that makes me think of the sort of box setification of TV via streaming services often, and how sometimes something becomes popular, so more seasons are added to it, and it exhausts its own power of story, does it? I mean, stories just sometimes do collapse under their own weight, and you're thinking, gosh, this is just should have stopped a lot sooner. Knowing when to limit a story, it's a really important part of storytelling, isn't it?
I totally agree with that, Alex, actually. I've been thinking that a lot recently, that stories don't know how to end anymore. I think that's in a way that's a slightly different book, but they just can't end, and that they become soaps, and there is and endings are really difficult, because clearly, like, brands don't want to end, but they have a kind of, they often have a sort of a teleological story whereby we started on this tiny little scale. I'm thinking about the smoothies here. We started on this tiny little scale in the market, and look at us now, we're a huge global company, but we still care about those tiny little people in the market. So there is a kind of teleology there, but it's a sort of never-ending teleology where we can just get bigger and bigger and bigger.
I was just going to say, I fear we've all been watching the same very unsatisfying Netflix adaptations, or even the same unsatisfying books. That's what I'm getting at. But I mean, and obviously we could definitely go on talking about endings, but it's a whole other Peter Brooks book, I think, about how you round out a story. You must actually end, I think, right there. All of us plunged into this Don Quixote world. Terrifying.
Yeah, but we know when to end.
So, Jonathan, thank you very much for giving us so much to think about the power of story.
That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Lamorna Ash and Jonathan Taylor.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Lucy Ditchmont.
We'll be back next week, but for now, from Michael Keynes and from me, Alex Clark, goodbye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.